This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that change exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
You're about to listen to a brand new series of Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley. New episodes will be released weekly wherever you get your podcasts, but if you're in the UK, you can listen to the latest episodes a week early, first on BBC Sounds.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. This series, we're on the trail of swindlers, hustlers, and women on the make. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we travel around the world and back through time to meet women who didn't play by the rules. These aren't just historical whodunits, but more whydunits. What were their motives? And what might these audacious crimes tell us about women's lives today? Just before we begin, the cases we're about to talk about were covered in early episodes of this series of Lady Swindlers. So if you haven't listened to those yet, consider this your spoiler alert. Our Lady Swindlers commit a kaleidoscope of crimes. Celia Cooney, the stylish bobbed-haired bandit. For her, crime is just another cool, collected adventure.
I walked into the store cold as a cucumber, the little automatic hidden in my pocket. I was boss, and they stood in a line with their mouths gaping and their eyes popping, looking so silly.
Mary Bateman, the Yorkshire witch. She's not conning people, she's on a divine mission, allegedly.
It has pleased God to send me into the world that I might destroy the works of darkness.
For Catherine Murphy, who makes counterfeit money, the attraction is working from home at the kitchen table.
I was never concerned in such business as this, but three times. But I never pass any bad money in the neighbourhood.
And?
Annie Newbond. Anne Bruce Sutherland. Annie Ogilvy Bruce. Madame Le Baron de Burman Stewart. Annie Ogilvy White. Annie Frost. I am Mrs.
Annie Gordon Bailey. She knows that people like giving to charity and thinks that the best charitable cause is her own self. Today, I'm joined, as always, by our splendid in-house historian and my partner in crime, at least in the history of crime, Ros Crone. Welcome, Ros.
Hello, Lucy.
And in Lady Swindlers, we like bold women. That's why we're thrilled to have with us today the comedian, podcaster and screenwriter, Deborah Frances White. You will almost certainly have heard of her podcast, The Guilty Feminist. But now she's also published a book, Six Conversations We're Scared to Have. Welcome back, Deborah.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an unqualified delight to be here, Lucy.
We are looking forward to having some scary conversations with you.
Indeed, indeed. This is an exciting one. Female swindlers.
It is. And listeners, you need to know that Deborah is not looking that scary at the moment. She's looking quite twinkly.
That's my trick.
That's your trick.
They all look twinkly.
Deborah, what makes conversations scary and daunting, do you think?
Oh, it's a really good question. So the book I've written is about our time and the way that I started to feel that we couldn't have conversations anymore, that it was just you're in this team or you're in this team. And as soon as someone expressed empathy for somebody else, it was like, well, you're in their team. I was in a religious cult when I was younger. And I remember how it was and why I got out of it. And the rules were, here's what you think, it's given to you. If you doubt that, you've got to push those doubts out of your mind because that's Satan getting in your mind. And if anyone else is seen to be doubting it, you have to tell on them and they'll be shamed. And if they don't accept that, they'll be shunned. And I was like, oh my God, I'm in this again. I think we're all in a series of interconnecting cults. So if you're on Team Feminist, these are the rules. This is the language you can use. And you must defend and you must speak up for and you must constantly be exceedingly empathetic to the people in this group. We need to not just be empathetic to our team. We need to allow our affective empathy, our emotional empathy. When we don't use it, we erode our own humanity. When we dehumanize others, we refuse to see their point of view or feel anything for them.
Ros, let me ask you, when you've been unearthing cases for us to investigate on Lady Swindlers, have you ever come across a theme or a topic and you thought, that's a bit tricky, that's a bit daunting?
Not so much in Lady Swindlers, but certainly when we've been doing Lady Killers, there's often a preponderance of child killers. As a historian, I really try not to shy away from the tricky themes and topics. The purpose of history is to really explore and confront and understand the full diversity of the human experience. And I also think studying these difficult topics and themes in a past context can take the heat out. And then we can become more critical of our own value systems and societal structures.
I often think that the job of a historian, in one sentence, is to make people think it's more complicated than they had assumed. I have to admit that I have got a soft spot for a glamorous female criminal, a woman who steals with style, like Celia Cooney, who carried out armed robberies with her husband in New York in the 1920s.
I walked into the store cold as a cucumber, with both my hands in my fur coat pockets.
We'd like to hand it to the bobbed-haired bandit, Enright detectives say.
Now, obviously, we don't condone armed robbery here at Lady Swindlers, but what a cool name, the bobbed-haired bandit. I've got the same haircut, and if I ever took to crime, then I hope I'd get called that myself. I've given this some thought, actually. If I had a criminal nickname, I think that I might go for... Are you ready for this? Loose the noose.
Oh,
is that foretelling what's going to happen to you?
Me? Oh, no. Yes, that's a fatal flaw, isn't it? I don't want to be in the noose. I want to be the noose dispenser. I've come up with one for you as well, Ros. Would you like to hear it?
Okay.
You're right to look nervous. My crime name for Ros is the Pernicious Professor.
Nice.
Oh, absolutely. That's good, actually. Yeah, that's better than the one I came up with for myself.
What have you got?
Oh, easy. Cunning Crone.
Cunning Crone! That's brilliant.
If I were in the 20s... And in my 20s, as is a little dream of mine, I feel like I would be the debutante. As I'm getting older, maybe debris. I mean, listen, I'm just, maybe these are more drag names for me. I don't know. But I'm working on it. I'm working on it.
I've also got a name for you and me, Ros, if we go into an armed robbery partnership. Oh. Are you ready for this?
Go on.
Lucy the Looter and Ros the Robber. Looter Lucy and Robber Ros.
Okay.
I'm liking it. I think this is all to be workshopped. No bad ideas. Not all of them can be gold. Maybe the listeners could send some in for us.
Yes. Can we top Loose the Noose, please? Now, back to Celia Cooney with her bobbed hair. Before World War I, this hairstyle was mainly associated with bohemians and sex workers. But as time went on, other women began adopting it as a form of emancipation. Ros, what do you think Celia Cooney's fashion choices tell us about her?
Well, definitely that she was a young woman of her time. She wanted to be part of modern culture. She wanted the excitement and the glamour and fun of life in the 1920s. She wanted to look up to date. But it's really important to note that fashion choice, the bobbed hair, the shorter skirts, although it was symbolic of the new woman at this time, we shouldn't assume that ideas about liberation and new opportunities went hand in hand with wearing the fashion by certain people, because the destination for most women at this time remained marriage and motherhood. And ultimately, that's what Celia wanted. She wanted a nice home where she could bring up a family. She just wanted the luxuries that went along with it.
So the emancipation implied by her hair was kind of skin deep, really.
One thing I'm writing about is the flapper election, which is just after 1928, when all women got the vote who were 21 and over. And they called it the flapper election because they said, well, we don't know how flappers are going to vote. We know women vote with their husbands, they thought, but flappers, you know, and part of that was their clothes, is they don't wear corsets. Some of them wear trousers. They cut their hair short. they're promiscuous. Now, of course, as you're saying, Roslyn, that wasn't the case for everyone. Some of them are just cutting their hair. But some of them were doing that politically, and then that becomes the fashion. But then, of course, that changes the landscape. And, of course, the flappers did in large numbers vote Labour, and the Tories lost the election.
Are impractical fashion choices, high heels, for example, empowering for women, or is that just the patriarchy that's making our feet hurt?
High heels were originally worn by Middle Eastern soldiers so that they could stand up in the stirrups of their horse and also do some sword play. They weren't for walking, they were for riding a horse, which makes sense when you think about it. Then these Middle Eastern soldiers came over to Europe and everyone wanted to be them. And so men here started wearing high heels, especially short kings, I mean actual short kings. And then it was during a period where women started smoking pipes and wearing high heels to look more masculine. And then men gave them up because they weren't practical in revolutions. And we got stuck with them. If you personally feel really sexy or empowered by strutting down the street or into a party in high heels, you go for it. But it's just good to know the origin sometimes and to look at what we see as gendered. We're very quick as a society to go, that's masculine or that's feminine.
I also think there are certain fashion trends that have been invented in history specifically for men or women, and specifically for women, in order to accentuate ideas of what was beautiful at the time and to keep women in control. And I'm thinking there are things like the corset.
Definitely the corset, because yeah. Women had to keep lying on fainting couches. So it keeps them at home. It keeps them very limited.
Now, the bobbed head bandit was a young woman whose dream was a proper home for her unborn baby in strikingly unequal 1920s New York.
I'm not going to have my baby raised in a little 2x4 hole like I was. He's going to have a home, a decent home.
She decides that the only practical way to get this is armed robbery. That seems to be her motivation, doesn't it, Roz?
I think we've got to understand that New York, under all of that glitz and glamour and the Gatsby crew and everything, were lots of ordinary people, many of whom were really struggling. Celia's prospects were fairly poor, being a young woman, married, didn't really have any skills. And Ed, her husband, working in a garage, his prospects also looked poor. And of course, they had a baby on their way. Armed robbery, it was a bit of a silly idea, let's be honest. But they were young. They thought it was their only option. And they thought, we just need to do one. But of course, one becomes two, and so on. It's easy to see them as greedy, that they want things that they haven't earned. But how could they earn these things, given the lives that they had? What were their options for doing this legitimately?
I'm sure that we wouldn't struggle to find people like Celia Cooney, with lack of opportunity being part of the motives for their crime, in prison today.
Oh, God, no.
What do you think, Deborah? The state obviously now provides more for people than it did in 1920s New York, but it's still the case that opportunity isn't distributed equally, is it?
We have had a sort of an era where things got much easier and things are getting much more difficult again. We, in this country, fought for the NHS and fought for some social welfare net to help people. And now we see, you know, billionaires getting richer and richer and richer and average people getting poorer and poorer and poorer. And history tells us where we're going with this. I really wish that people in power found ways to make things more fair.
Let's go back to the early 19th century. In Britain, the so-called Age of Reason has been going on for a while. Yet somehow, Mary Bateman, the Yorkshire witch, is thriving. Her supernatural services are in high demand among the shifting, growing, changing population of early industrial Leeds. People turn to her to heal illness, to tell fortunes, and perhaps to find meaning in the chaos of rapid urbanisation. But let's be clear, Mary's work is far from harmless. Her magic potions lead to at least one person's certain death. And on top of that, this is awful, she's cruel to her hen. Yes, her hen, which she claimed was laying eggs, inscribed with the message, "Christ is coming." Turns out Mary was just pushing the eggs back into the poor old chicken's duct. But Mary seems to have plenty of people under her spell.
"I will not take you under my hand, unless you promise never to mention a word of what is going on."
Roz, how did society view witchcraft at this particular point in time?
Well, legally, pretending to use witchcraft or magic or sorcery or even telling fortunes was seen as a crime. And that's because of the 1735 Witchcraft Act. Now, the change in the law reflected changing opinion among the more educated in society. However, beliefs in magic and the supernatural really persisted among ordinary people in society. And if anything, they continued to be quite vigorous and were even spread by new forms of popular literature in the late 18th and early 19th centuries.
So this Witchcraft Act of 1735 obviously didn't work. It didn't change hearts and minds, Deborah. Do you think that law has a place in making people change their beliefs?
I mean, it clearly does, because a lot of people were against the decriminalisation of homosexuality. But enough people were for it, and you then have to decriminalise it, and then the environment changes until it becomes no big deal. But we're seeing laws changed in America now, which are very frightening to vulnerable people, because if the law changes, people get used to whatever bathwater they're in, don't they? So that's why we have to be so careful.
What would you do to change people's minds?
You know, Coca-Cola do not advertise by saying, screw you if you drink Pepsi. That's not persuasive. Why are we not at least as interested as capitalists selling sugar water in how to persuade with our big ideas that we think are going to change the world? It's not that there's no place for anger. Anger is a great motivating tool, but it cannot be the only tool in our box, because there's lots of people who could be persuaded rather than told off. We see in police states, you know, police states just...
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
Make the laws that the most powerful people want. And we see people underneath planning revolution, finding ways.
So the answer is conversation, taking people step by step.
Yes, and listening to them.
Now, I can't help but notice that most of Mary Bateman's known victims were female, including the hen, actually. And naturally, people who couldn't afford the doctor or who thought that the doctor wasn't for them turned to other females for advice. Deborah, do you think that it's still the case that women sometimes feel let down by modern medicine?
I think there's so much evidence that that is absolutely true. And for a long time, there was no research on women's bodies at all, because there was an assumption that our menstrual cycle created too much like white noise. I am so adamant that we please, please put more funding into women's medicine and just allowing women into that conversation and let women be believed. So many women report they go to the doctor and they might as well be Victorian because they're told they're hysterical, basically. Although Rosson might tell me that I'm imposing that on Victorians who, in fact, never believed in hysteria in women. But if so, sorry, Victorians. I feel like we're still there in some ways, that women are just told lose weight or it's probably your period or maybe you're perimenopausal. And it is just so many times not the case.
Now, you won't be surprised to hear this, Deborah, but after Mary Bateman was hanged, her body was handed over to surgeons for dissection and study. And interestingly, the violation of her body was supposed to be a kind of further punishment for having murdered. But it also had a pragmatic purpose, which is that female bodies were much less readily available to the medical profession. I'd also like to bring in here the unfortunate moneymaker, Catherine Murphy.
Virtue young females never forsake. The laws of your country do not break.
She was also hanged for counterfeiting coins on her kitchen table. And then her corpse, in this weird legal echo of an earlier punishment, was burnt at the stake. Ros, tell us more about how women's bodies were treated differently from men in the past.
Well, you've mentioned Mary Bateman and her dissection. And of course, here we see some equality in the law because the 1752 Murder Act said that the bodies of both men and women who were convicted of murder and hanged were to be sent to dissection. But of course, it was rarer to have female murderers, and so they attracted more interest. And so more people would come and see the public dissection.
Public dissection?
Yeah, yeah. This was done in public.
There was an audience.
There was in England, and they charged as well for people to come and see it.
Well, I suppose they didn't have Netflix. It's great to see equality in one area, i.e. if you're a murderer, it doesn't matter if you're a man or woman, equal opportunities for public dissection.
Equal opportunities there, but not everywhere. Now, for a similar reason, which is this kind of attraction of the naked and exposed female body, women who were convicted of treason were burnt at the stake, but men who were convicted of treason were hanged and then disemboweled and quartered.
All of it sounds awful, but that sounds much worse for women. Why were we burnt at the stake if men were hanged?
According to historians, it's thought that burning at the stake was used as the alternative punishment because it was felt that it would be indecent and indelicate to quarter and disembowel women in front of an audience. But to be honest, I don't 100% buy it.
Why though? If not indecency, then what?
I do think there's more work to be done in this area. There are other points in history where men are burned at the stake, for example, as heretics under Mary Tudor. But from the late 17th century, it's only women. And as the equivalent punishment for male coiners, the disemboweling and quartering was abandoned, we cannot but see the burning of women as gendered, as a horrific assault on the female body that must have been symbolic, especially because burning was also the punishment for women who had killed their husbands. So arguably, female coiners just got caught up in this.
Moving on, I wish we had time to cover all of the crimes of Annie Gordon Bailey. She's got more than 40 false names. And it seems as many different swindles too. Ross, would you give Deborah a refresher on Annie's extraordinary story?
Yeah, sure. Hold on to your hats. Annie Gordon Bailey was a lifelong swindler. She rented houses, stayed in fancy hotels, ordered groceries, clothes, jewellery, all on credit. She collected donations for charitable causes, but she pocketed all the money. She didn't stick in one place. She moved from Scotland to England to Italy and back again. Later to New York, and then to New Zealand and Australia. She adopted an aristocratic persona and charmed her way into high society. She rubbed shoulders with politicians, and for a while she was famous. She gave interviews to newspapers all about her philanthropic schemes. But behind all this glamour was a trail of unpaid bills, which finally caught up with her.
From what I can tell, Annie relied on sort of half-truths to get away with it. There was always a bit of something in what she claimed, but if you grasped at her story, it kind of fizzled away. And this kind of twisting of the truth is something I can't help but notice going on around the world today. Listen to her here. She's defending herself after being arrested for fraud.
I look at this affair in the light of an innocent person. As an injured woman, a maligned woman. Why, when you separate the distinct charges from the clouds of vague, general accusations which have been made in court, what have we? The thing is absurd.
We're seeing a lot of this kind of behaviour now. Maybe we've always seen a lot of it, and now they're making dramas about it and documentaries about it. I think something they all have in common is massive disassociation, where they go, I didn't do this. I don't know what you're talking about. It is clear that people who do this kind of thing are able to just tell a story and believe that story.
Do you think that Annie Bailey kind of lost her real self in these roles that she invented? Did she become her own act? Do you think that's possible?
I think it's very, very easy to become your own act. Lots of people reinvent themselves a bit. I've done that. I'm basically Muriel from Muriel's Wedding. But I had a reason, as I told you before, I was in a cult when I was younger. I had a reason to kind of go, I need to start over. But I think I started over as a more authentic version of myself because a cult makes you be a cookie cutter person. And I think that's a totally normal human thing to do, and to change and grow into yourself and try something new and go, yeah, this feels great. Why can't I be this? I think your authentic self is really just your habitual self. You can grow into being any kind of person you want. But if you're telling people you're an aristocrat and you're then trying to get money out of them, it's not just about you and how you feel and you present to the world, but you're trying to get something from someone else based on a completely false narrative, then I think in some ways you have to believe it.
When Annie adopted her various personas, such as lady novelist, that was one of them, philanthropist, that was another, she managed to convince people that she was authentic, that she was, in today's language, bringing her whole self to work. What do you think, Deborah? Is that a good thing to do?
Oh, my God. No, they don't mean it when they say bring your whole self to work. Nobody means it. What they mean is bring a bit more of your best self. Leave your worst self at home for the people who love you the most, your family. That's where you can take out your worst self. If we brought our whole self to work, we'd just call someone a numpty and be fired. I think we should basically be who we are and say what we mean. But authenticity is quite limiting, because if you're authentically crap at something, you're sort of stuck with it. I'm frightened of riding a horse. But if I did it every day for a year, it would just be what I did.
You fake it till you make it.
Yeah, or just even, you don't even think you need to fake it. You just need to show up and do it a lot.
Well, Annie certainly did that. Deborah, to finish up, what do you personally take away from these four women's stories?
What I take away is that at a time when there was a lot more inequality and there were no ways of women earning money, really, or owning the money that they'd earned. And Rosalind, you're saying that's not true. But I think overall, didn't your father or your husband own your money?
I think you could say that women had fewer opportunities for paid work than men. Mm-hmm. I think you can say that women were paid less than men. And so it was harder to survive on a female wage. And I think you can also say, in the context of married women, of course, they had to hand their wages over until the late 19th century, technically speaking, because of the doctrine of coverture.
So exactly what Rosalind said there was what I meant. This is what I want Rosalind in my life all the time. Could you just follow me round? And I can just go, do I mean this? And then Rosalind will go, I know what you mean, but I'll say it in accurate words. I feel like if we give in to the measures that are really coming out of America, influencing Europe and the globe, to take more autonomy away from women, and if we allow this widening inequality to come back, we're going to see more women and men take desperate measures. So I think what we've got to learn is we must never again allow those circumstances to prevail.
I also think that a lot of crime is opportunistic. And we also have to realize that crime is socially constructed. So it's about who we aim at in society and whose behavior we want to change or regulate. There are actions by other classes in society, not just those who are desperate and everything, that are not classified as crimes, but they do harms as well, if that makes sense to you.
Yes, it's a great reframing to say, but hold on. If billionaires are changing laws to suit themselves and creaming money off the top, or then going, oh, I'll regulate myself to see whether or not I've got any conflicts of interest here, then why is that not a crime? Because the people in power haven't made it a crime. So that's an absolutely brilliant reframing, Rosalind.
Well, I think that our lady swindlers have showed us that being bold might be only a step away from being desperate. These women felt that the world was stacked against them. For women living in the past, it surely often was. But then this lot made some bad choices that we hope we wouldn't make ourselves. Yet it's hard for us to imagine how difficult their lives might have been in that foreign country called the past. I'd love to be able to bring them back to life and to sit down with them and to ask them. Because I think we've concluded that although it can be a painful thing to have, one of the best things in the world is a difficult conversation. Well, a huge thank you to Deborah Francis-White and Professor Rosalind Crone. Next time on Lady Swindlers, we meet a prolific lady burglar. When night falls, London homeowners rightly fear that she'll find a way in. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Reham Musa, and the readers are Claire Corbett, Lauren Lefko, Jonathan Keeble, and Alex Phelps. The singer is Olivia Bloor. The historical consultant is Rosalind Crone. The commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhiann Roberts, and the executive producer is Kirsty Hunter. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4.
And you can catch up with Lady Swindlers weekly on BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is Dr. Chris.
And Dr. Zand here, and we are dropping in to let you know about our new BBC Radio 4 podcast.
In What's Up, Docs, we are going to be diving into the messy, complicated world of health and well-being, because it can be confusing, can't it, Zand?
That's right, Chris. The mass of information out there can be contradictory, it can be overwhelming, and Chris and I get confused too.
That's right. We get seduced by the marketing, the hype, the trends, so we want to be your guides through it. And I think it's fair to say, Zand, we are going to be getting personal.
We're absolutely going to be getting personal, Chris. What I want to do is bring in my own health dilemmas in the hope that we can help you with yours.
Listen and subscribe to What's Up Docs on BBC Sounds.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Jochi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.